I'm an incurable people watcher, and I've always found it very interesting to watch in a group how people work out who's going to be in charge if it's not already worked out. You know, go to the homeowners association meeting and just watch instead of being mad. And go to a club as people work out who's going to do what and who's not. And one of our first mission trip to Lakeshore, now a long time ago, we joined together with a church from Kansas, and you know, we kind of just, it has to settle out. Somebody's going to point and grunt more than somebody else. You have to cooperate with other people. Someone has to do the leading, and so sometimes it's very natural, like it was on that trip. We just kind of settled out into our own particular jobs, and their pastor and I worked well together, and Greg showed us all what to do, and it was a good trip. But working together with other people requires, absolutely requires, that someone lead and someone else be led. It won't work any other way. Now, this can be accomplished in a lot of ways. Sometimes there's an election. Sometimes if there is an election, the people who are elected actually do the job they're assigned. Sometimes authority is taken by force. It could be a military campaign, it could be a verbal barrage, it could be a strong personality taking over your club. Sometimes it's that natural, casual kind of settling out that we had on that very memorable mission trip. Some groups try to avoid the system entirely by voting on everything, but if you've ever been in the loop on that, you know that behind the scenes, someone is still deciding a lot, and then a lot of energy of the leaders is pointed toward determining the outcome of those votes or even what gets to the vote. Specific circumstances and people determine the details, but in all human cooperation, there must be a leader and a follower. There's no other way for it to work. Sometimes casual and hardly noticed, sometimes very obvious and at the other end of the spectrum, but there is always, always someone who leads and someone who follows. Now, authority and submission are just an unavoidable part of life. And so they are, those things are a part of life where we tend to have a lot of problems, a lot of strife in this world over who's going to decide and who's going to not get to decide and have to follow. And because this is such an important issue, this is something that God has had a lot to say about in His Scripture. I would point out to you this morning that God is the one who created a world in which it is impossible for every one of us to have equal decision-making power. It is absolutely, fundamentally impossible. As much as our hearts would like to be in charge all the time, it simply cannot be. And it cannot be because God created the world the way He did. It is His design that makes authority and submission a necessary part of living in this world. All authority is derived from God, or taken from Him in rebellion against Him. But God has established systems for authority and submission and imposed them on us for our good. He made it this way. One example of that is government. Much as we dislike certain aspects of government, this is a system that God gave us for our good. Romans 13 has a lot to say about our government and what our attitude ought to be as we submit to it. And the core unit of authority and submission that God created and gave to us, the core unit, is the family. God established the family, and God says who's going to be in the lead and who's going to be in submission within the family. God has given us very specific instructions regarding authority and submission within this core unit that He has set up for all societies, for all people. Last week, we looked at one of those commands in Colossians 3:18. It says, "Wives, be subject to your husbands, as is fitting in the Lord." That verse, along with many others in Scripture, indicates clearly that God has assigned the leadership of the home to the husband and not to the wife. If we operate outside of that system of derived authority, then we don't have real authority. We've got something else. If we set aside God's derived authority and God's biblical system for the home, then stuff gets decided another way. It might be oppression, or deception, or extortion, or intimidation, or manipulation, but it's not biblical authority if we set aside the husband from the role of leadership. If the husband lays down his God-given role, or if the wife says, "I'm not following," then that family is forced into some other model which is no longer derived authority, but rebellion against God. Now, we talked about the wives last week, and we were kind of hard on the wives because we were saying what God says to the wives. Kind of hard on the husbands, too, last week. Ladies, you get to sit back, try to get through the whole week without going, "Dave said," and gentlemen, put on your seatbelts because the next one's for us, husbands. I want to read the whole passage that we looked at last week, and then we're going to come down to the God-given role of the husband. It's Colossians chapter 3, verses 18 through 22. Colossians 3, 18 through 22. It says, "Wives, be subject to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they will not lose heart. Slaves, in all things, obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord." Now, all of the commands in this section involve leading and submitting within a system that God has set up for our good. It's unavoidable that we would lead or submit or take turns at some of those things, but this tells us how to go about it. All of these commands are about how we function in that system of authority and submission. The first four categories mentioned here involve the family specifically. Within the family, God has given the husband the role of leadership. He has not given that role to the wife, and he has not given it to the children, in spite of what might be commonly practiced. And so, gentlemen, you must lead. That is the clearest implication of this passage. Men, you must lead at home. It's not enough for you to be a tough guy at work and come home and be passive. You must lead at home. Now, a lot of people think that that sounds very easy. Most people think that they want to be in charge. Most people flatter themselves that they could lead much more effectively than the person who is leading right now in any given circumstance. Children almost always think this of their parents at some point in their life. Suddenly they know everything and their parents know nothing. Employees seem to almost always think this of their employers. "I could do it better than he's doing it. I've never done it before. I don't know anything about the job, but I don't like this, so I'm sure I could do it better." We're ready to take that on, aren't we? Most people think this is easy. And I could take on that role of leadership and do a great job, and they're ready to step in with high expectations of immediate success. Well, real leadership is very different from what most people envision it to be. Instead of ease and autonomy and power and fun, real leadership should be understood more in terms of greater responsibility. You get to the top of that chart, there's less room for you to wiggle. Think about it in terms of more work, more accountability, more restrictions on your personal freedom. That's what leadership is. It's not just autonomy with your slaves to do what you want. It's you having to decide things that impact other people. Your freedoms are restricted. You're accountable for what you do. It's a serious business. If you believe that leadership is easy, then I want to make a case to you this morning. The family, which is what we're talking about, we're faced with in this passage as we look at verse 19 today in particular. The family is the smallest unit of significant leadership available on this planet, right? It is by far the most common opportunity for men to demonstrate their leadership ability. Far more than any other realm, a man can give it a try here. The family provides the most practice in the area of leadership, at least for the men who are married. You know, you've got perpetual opportunities. In this God-given system of male leadership, the family gives an opportunity for gradual advancement. In the beginning, most of the time, there's just a wife to consider. Just her needs. And then, generally, babies come along one at a time with a considerable warning period. Sometimes guys get twins or even triplets, but most of the time, you ramp up to this thing kind of slowly. And at first, there's not that much to do. You're supervising feeding, diaper changing, and sleep deprivation. But they stay where you put them, and they don't talk back yet. You've got 12 years to prepare for having a teenager. This is a benign learning curve, isn't it? You just ease into this thing. You don't have to have a lot of skills at first. You can get them as you go. So, gentlemen, if you've got leadership ability, you ought to be able to show it at home. And God says the family is the proving ground for whether or not you're a leader. One of the qualifications for an elder, which is stated in 1 Timothy 3 and 4, is this. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Now, among other things, what that passage is saying is that it is easier to lead a home than it is to lead a church. And if a man can't prove it at home, for heaven's sakes, don't give him the harder job of leading the church. Home is the easy place to lead. Considering the needs of one or two or several other people is far easier than most opportunities for leadership that might come up in this world. Leadership at work might include dozens or hundreds or thousands of families that are impacted by the decisions you make. Everybody's ready to take that on. Leadership at work might include multiple millions of dollars in assets instead of one home and two cars and some worn-out toys. And everybody's ready. Everybody's ready. And yet with one household and a handful of people, frankly, most men demonstrate little or no leadership ability at all. I mean, just think about the world you live in. If the family is the proving ground for leadership, as God says it is, then what the family most often proves is that men tend to be lousy leaders. There are very few who are ready to lead. So we're not talking about easy stuff. I don't want anybody going out of here with the illusion that this is lightweight stuff, gentlemen. So when you hear something like we talked about last week, wives, be subject to your husbands. Some men's hearts rejoice because they're going to be king of their castle, ruler of their domain, and have a servant ready at their beck and call at all times. However, if you're in touch with reality, you might tremble instead at the thought of the responsibility that God has put on your shoulders, that the decisions you make will affect the lives of these precious people whom you love. A serious-minded gentleman will look to God and cry out for help because this is not easy stuff. But in the spectrum of leadership, the family is the easier of the places you might lead, the easiest. So since most men fail at the easy stuff, we need to be very serious as we approach this issue of authority and submission in the home and the responsibilities that God has put on our shoulders, men. How can we succeed where so many men have failed miserably? How can we handle well this God-given role we didn't sign up for, but we had imposed on us by our Creator? How can we do it? Well, this command in verse 19 of Colossians 3 tells you where you must begin. Husbands, love your wives. In a household, in a family, there is at least a wife. There may or may not be children, but there is a wife. And so that's where you have to start. Husbands, love your wives. Now, before you think this is an unrelated topic, this is the solution to leadership problems. This is the key to success for men who want to lead their households well. Biblical leadership is rooted and grounded in godly love. In every realm, love is the key to effective leadership. And it's certainly the case in the home. Gentlemen, most of the time, if there's a problem in a home, if there's a serious problem in a home, the responsibility lies with the father or the husband. Most of it, most of the time. And the problem is a lack of love in the husband. When I was a youth minister many years ago, the pastor of that church, as we talked about some problem kids that we were trying to minister to, he said, well, the problem in that home is the dad. And then he said a statement that blew my mind. I thought he was crazy, and now I think he might have understated it. He said, 90% of the time, if there's a problem in a home, it's the dad. And I thought he was nuts, and now I've lived a little more, and I think he softened the blow more than he might have. Not always, but most of the time, if there's a serious problem, it's the dad. It's the husband who must take the responsibility for that problem. If God has given you the role of authority, then you have more influence. There's something you haven't addressed if there's a serious problem. Now, sometimes we don't know what to do. Occasionally, we make leadership mistakes because of a lack of insight or a lack of skill or a lack of experience. And so we blunder. But those mistakes are easy to forgive. They're easy to forget. They're easy for the wife and the children to pull together with you and get beyond whatever the ramifications are in a household where there is love. But in a household where there is not love, this stuff builds up over time. So there's going to be somebody that needs ongoing counseling. Families where love is abundant, they just pull together through the mistakes, through the hardships, through whatever comes along. So most of the time, it's not a blunder that leads to any real problems. There's just stuff to get through. There's just work to be done with that. But if there's selfishness in the leader of that home, there's going to be problems. And self-centeredness is simply a lack of love. It's a lack of biblical love, godly love. Gentlemen, it's very likely there's something at your house right now, your household, that you don't want to deal with because it's going to be uncomfortable for you. It might be that there's something you don't want to say because it will be uncomfortable for you. You know you need to say it. You know you need to deal with it. You know you need to face it. But you don't want to because you're being selfish. And so you're protecting your comfort at the cost of your family. This is the opposite of biblical love. Maybe there's something you need to sacrifice. Maybe you're using up too much of the budget on your toys, or maybe there's some other issue in your household where you need to take it on the chin and let somebody else have something good, but you won't because you're selfish. Now, that stuff over time builds up to be big trouble. Now, we see the results of selfish leadership all the time in the world. Years ago, my wife worked at Lockheed down in Marietta. She was one of the engineers working on the cockpit display on the C-130J. They were updating this airplane so that women could fly it, and everything was too far away for the smaller statue of the typical new Air Force lady, and so they had to redo the whole cockpit, and Sharon was in there changing 40-year-old light bulbs and rewiring stuff. And somewhere up the ladder at Lockheed, there was a manager that she didn't even know, who had a budgetary goal to meet. And so he informed my wife's group leader that he needed to find out which engineers in his group didn't need voicemail on their telephone because he was going to cut cost, and he had to eliminate a certain number of voicemail boxes from a certain number of telephones. And some engineers worked in the lab, and they never needed a phone anyway, and so they were just going to save some costs. Well, Sharon's group leader responded that this group deals with vendors. You know, we're here to make sure the vendors send the right stuff, that they do what they said they were going to do. We're on the phone all day, every day. We all need voicemail, and he thought that was the end of it. So this manager up the ladder that nobody even knew decided to just randomly cut voicemails until he met his target. And Sharon's voicemail was eliminated. Now, it cost about $5 a phone line then to have voicemail. I won't tell you what an electrical engineer's salary costs. So you got $60 a month versus the efficiency of an electrical engineer salary. But frustrated vendors and wasted time for an engineer didn't show up on this man's budget. So he torpedoed the stockholders, the pilots, my wife, the vendors, to save $5 a month and meet his goal. We just had to laugh because she could come home and that was the end of that, you know. But that kind of foolish, self-centered decision-making hurts people. It reduces trust. It leads to tremendous frustration. And in a household, a husband can do that kind of foolishness multiple times in a day. Day after day, week after week, year after year, a selfish husband can offend his wife several times in a given day, imposing on her, frustrating her, until over time, he's fostered an environment of mistrust and fear and frustration and pain until he's created a household in which nobody wants to live. And then when it gets really, really edgy, the selfish husband responds by becoming oppressive and makes it worse. So give it 5 years or 10 years, and then you wonder why your teenagers don't act right. Well, it's not because of their age. It's because you've cultivated such an environment for so long, nobody trusts you anymore. The results are absolutely devastating. It's like a snowball coming down a hill. It's not much at first. But give it time, and somebody's going to need some serious counseling. Most of the time, because the husband is selfish. Now, that stuff is just the opposite of what this passage commands. So, gentlemen, here's where your responsibility begins. Love your wives. Love them. This word is agapate. It is the present active imperative form of agape. It means it's a command. It's continual. You're commanded continually to love your wife with a godly kind of love. This is not the you make me feel good kind of love that secular songs are about. This is the kind of love with which God has loved us. Selfless love, active love. God has given you, gentlemen, the leadership role in your home. And with that delegated authority, your first responsibility is to love your wife with godly love. Agape love is love that's based on character of the lover rather than the loveliness of the recipient. Now, that means, husbands, that you love your wife because you're loving, not because she's lovely. I know she is. You wouldn't have married her if she wasn't, but that's not why you love her. You love her because of your own character if you love her this way. And this way it still works no matter what changes over the years. It's based in your character, not in whether someone younger looks better now or someone else's personality makes you laugh more now or anything like that. If we obey this command, we love the wife, not because she's the most lovable creature we can imagine, not because she deserves our love every moment of every day, not because she's so wonderful we can't help ourselves. We love her because of who we are. Agape love is intentional and willful. Whether we do this or not has nothing to do with our wives. We have no excuse, in other words, if we won't do this. Because it's our character that's in question, not the loveliness of our wives. This kind of love is also active. It's not a feeling. It's not responding to anything. It's initiating action toward the wife. You love your wife because of your character, but you love her in specific ways based on her need. You're actively thinking about it and doing things that will bless her. It's selfless love. We get the idea of how this love works from a similar passage in the book of Ephesians. It's Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, if you'd like to turn to that. One of the guys last week came up afterward and said, man, next week's going to be tough because... Well, actually, he said, this one's easier than the one in Ephesians, I think is how he put it. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. It's talking about the same love. It says, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any other thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. That's tough. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Jesus' sacrifice on the cross for us was not because of our beauty. It's not because he liked our personality the most. We had no beauty and our personality was at war with God. His sacrifice was based in his character, but it was applied to our need. He paid the debt that we could not pay. He established us with the Father. He made us pure by his own shed blood. This is the perfect picture of agape love. This is the kind of love, gentlemen, you're commanded to have for your wife. This is the perfect picture of what we're supposed to be doing. Husbands, love your wives with that kind of love. The kind that gives itself up for the one who is loved. Now, this is exactly the opposite of the world's attitudes about love. The world's definitions of love. In the world, someone, you know, you love them if they please you. And then you act toward them in ways that will increase that selfish pleasure, right? I just can't stop loving you, you know. Can't help myself. You're just too wonderful. It just oozes all over me, and then you fall out, right? It's always down. Fall in, and then you fall out of love. You're always falling in the world. But we're to love as Christ loved us. Sacrificing for the sake of the beloved, acting to meet our wives' needs. Love your wives. Now that's the first command of this passage. There is another. It says, husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Do not be embittered is also a command. It's in the passive voice, which means you're not to let this happen to you. You're not to let yourself become bitter. Sometimes bitterness comes at you from outside. Maybe your wife's not responding well to your love. Maybe she's not obeying the command to submit. Maybe she's not treating you with respect. Sometimes bitterness comes from within you. You had false expectations. You idolized them. You had your list. My wife's going to be this and this and this. And now you're 15, 20 years into this deal and you realized it's not ever going to happen. That's not who she is. And because it was an idol in your heart, you were worshiping it. Now you're mad at God and you're mad at her. But you're going to take it out on her because nobody wants to fight with God, right? Bitterness. Whether you had biblical hopes that are not being met by your wife, or whether you had sinful, idolatrous expectations that you didn't get, either way, you don't have any right to be bitter. You have to keep it from happening in your heart. It's a serious problem, men. It's a common problem. It's a sin we would justify to ourselves based on somebody else's character or actions, or the fact that she doesn't even quite get our preferences in this area or that area. But there's no justification. The command is here, do not be embittered against them. It leaves you no excuse. There's no sub-clause about except if you didn't get your way. Love your wives. Love your wives without allowing bitterness to take over your thinking and your heart. Now, these are commands that only a true Christian can even begin to obey. Think about what is being called for here. To love with a godly kind of love, to be unselfish in leadership, and to be able to resist the pull of sin on our own hearts so that we're not made bitter. That's a pretty big package. These are things that cannot be accomplished without a personal relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ in which He has changed you. We function by trusting God. First, for His provision for our salvation by the shed blood of Christ. And then in our sanctification, we're going to walk with Him. We're going to look to Him. Because He has changed us, we can follow Him. So if you're here this morning and you have never humbled your heart before your Maker and cried out for mercy and asked for His salvation, that's where you have to start. You can never have a biblical home. You can never have peace. You can never have the comfort that God designed you to have until you humble yourself before your Maker and you cry out to Him for mercy and you believe in His provision for your salvation. As long as you're still trying to make a deal with God, you're never going to get anywhere. When you realize that you just needed help and you come to Him like a beggar who has nothing to offer, then He saves. Jesus said, I didn't come for the well, I came for the sick. It's only the sick that need a physician. If you don't think you need help, Jesus is not going to do anything for you. Recognize your bankruptcy spiritually and cry out to Him and be saved. Let's pray.